Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman, and tonight's special co-host, Kurt McKenzie. We also have live online with us already is Dr. Richard Gierak. And Red, before we have Kirk introduce our guest tonight, would you open us with a prayer, please?
I'll give it a try. Heavenly Father, we come to you recognizing our inability to fix the problems that confront the United States of America as we do this program tonight. It's beyond us. It's going to take the power of an almighty God to help us to bring this government back to what it should be and to where it would be pleasing to you. We thank thee for the privilege of speaking out, and we just pray that you would give us the words to speak. Give us the message you want us to deliver to the American people. We need your help, and somehow or other help us to be tools that you can use to help bring about a lawful, orderly return to legal and lawful government. We thank thee for this privilege and ask your blessing on the guests and everybody that's here, and we'll give you the praise in Christ's name. Amen.
Okay, Terry, you back on? I'll wait for Terry. Richard, are you there? Dr. Gierak?
Yeah, I'm here. No problem, Mr. Dodd.
Okay, so this is Kirk. We'll actually go ahead and give Terry, I think Terry needs to dial back in. Why don't you go ahead and give us a brief introduction about yourself?
Well, I'm Dr. Richard Gierak. I've lived on the Klamath River for the last 25 years on a historic bar named Woodrat Bar. I hold degrees in biology, chemistry, a doctorate in healing arts. In 1999, I was elected as the National Whip of the Property Rights Congress. In 2001, I was a participant in the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's Fish Passage Advisory Team and Hatchery Evaluation Team on Iron Gate Hatchery on the Klamath River. At the present time, I'm science consultant to the Siskiyou County Water Users Association. We in the Pacific Northwest are under attack by environmental groups and government agencies to implement the UN Agenda 21 protocol by removing all dams for the supposed benefit to fish, regardless of the loss of clean hydroelectric energy and what it does to rural America.
So let's take this one step at a time. So for the listener's sake, I met Dr. Gierak when I made my trip up to Siskiyou County, and he was one of the people that I filmed as part of the documentary, which you can view on the DefendRuralAmerica.com website. And is a wealth of information, has studied this for a long period of time. He's looked into the science, and so I think perhaps we can walk through a bit of that. So let's kind of set the stage for this. There are four dams on the Klamath River which the government wants to blow up or destroy, and the argument being that by doing so, the salmon will be able to go further upstream in order to increase the spawning grounds, and therefore more of the coho salmon presumably will be hatched. And let's just take this a step at a time. These of the four dams, one is in the southern part of Oregon, that's the John C. Boyle Dam, And then coming downstream a bit, there's three more dams, which are in Siskiyou County, probably within about 5 miles of each other. And those are the ones that most directly impact the people there in Siskiyou County, and including Dr. Jurek. The argument is the coho salmon is an endangered species and therefore comes under the Endangered Species Act. And under that act, then nothing else matters, only the coho salmon, and whatever is needed to coho salmon is what theoretically they would like to see become the law and so forth. So let me ask the first question. Is the coho salmon about to go extinct?
Well, actually, according to the expert panel in 2010, they indicated that coho salmon in the Klamath Basin were on the verge of extinction. However, they're so far off the base, it's ridiculous. The total number of salmon from 1950 to this year, regarding coho salmon, the numbers haven't changed at all. The problem is that the coho salmon have moved north into Alaskan waters due to a very high increase in temperature of the Pacific Ocean. And they're not even our own salmon. These came from Oregon.
So let's just take this a piece at a time. So you're saying they're not in layman's terms. This is not a species that's about to go extinct. And the fact that my own little quick research on Wikipedia, you discover they've been stocked in reservoirs throughout the United States, even up in the Great Lake. The Great Lakes. Is that correct?
Yeah, and they're doing just fine. However,
go ahead.
Coho salmon really are a very poor eating species. Even the tribal members that do eat them occasionally really don't care for them. They are nothing like the king salmon, which is the Chinook. There's your true, wonderful-tasting salmon. Coho are not that good.
So how is it that they then conclude that they're endangered? Under what if they're truly not going extinct, then we have to kind of look and try and understand what the heck this Endangered Species Act really does. So under what definition did they conclude that they're endangered?
Well, actually, they listed the coho salmon back in the 90s and tried to go ahead and enforce a 300-foot from the edge of a river. And that includes private property, which meant you couldn't put gravel on your roads, roof your house, or do anything without a, quote, environmental impact statement and a federal permit, which could cost you thousands and take years. However, we went ahead and fought that very diligently. And the reasons they listed them, they quit counting the hatchery fish, which make up the bulk of the returning fish. So what they did was, is we went ahead and filed against them that to go ahead and do anything other than water and substrate. Got to remember that the Klamath River is a, quote, navigable river, which falls under the Department of Commerce. And falling under the Department of Commerce, only essential fish habitat applies, which means water and substrate only, not 1 inch of dry land. But they were trying to change the definition of that to the ESA definition, which means they could take property up to a mile away and regulate it. So this is how we got into that problem. But fortunately, we tied in with the Grange states of Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and California, and we went ahead and went to meetings from Washington, D.C., from Seattle, all the way to Reno. And at the last moment when they decided they were going to take the vote on changing the definition in violation of Congress, they did not change it. And once again, once they counted hatchery fish, the listings went away from Southern Oregon and Northern California.
Now, as I understand it, you can correct me here, the Endangered Species Act, at least as it's being interpreted now, is actually what it does is divides everyone up or areas into areas where a species theoretically is native, and it looks at each individual area separately. It's not, you could have 99% of the areas that are perfectly thriving, but they actually say, oh, in this area, there are not enough of them. This is an area where this species is native. We don't think there are as many as there should be, therefore they're endangered in this area. So the interpretation of the act actually has nothing to do with extinction per se. It's now being defined, I think, in specific areas as to how many they believe are there versus how many should be. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. They call them ESUs. And Southern Oregon and Northern California is the one that's been targeted this time. And
so
once again, the salmon are not endangered. They've just moved because of the ocean temperature. And the other thing that's absurd about taking down the dams is 85% of coho salmon spawn within 20 miles of the coast. They are not a species that normally goes up a river.
Okay, but let's come back to this question. I want to get this one thing out on the table here. So in order to qualify under the Endangered Species Act, quote, they can be endangered, they have to be native to the particular area. Are coho salmon native to the Klamath River?
No, not at all. They were first planted in 1895, and then three fish biologists in 1931, 36 years after the initial plantings, they claim they were here all the while. However, the Karuk tribe and the Shasta Nation, which have been here for centuries on this basin, they've indicated they were never here before the plantings. So I think we've got pretty good proof.
So is there any written documentation anywhere, books, novels, federal documents, anything that indicates that the coho salmon is native to this area? Anything in writing?
Not one particular document of any type exists that say they were native. The only real document we have is from the Karuk Tribal Council meeting in 2001, where they clearly stated coho were never native to this river, and why should they try to bring them here? And we have a copy of that document.
So if they're not native, then they don't qualify under the Endangered Species Act. Is that correct?
That's correct. Well, you have to remember that the first listing was by National Marine Fisheries Service, and we defeated them. This time, California Endangered Species Act listed them. National Marine Fisheries Service is still not listed as endangered, just threatened. And threatened means no regulatory action whatsoever.
Okay.
In fact, the California listing, until one slight thing took place in 1970, the Dormant Commerce Clause states specifically that on a river that falls under the Commerce Clause, which this river does, a state can list the fish or any wildlife they like to, but they can take absolutely zero regulatory action. But one case in 1970 created a loophole in that document. And so that's how California now is listing them as endangered.
So in your opinion, it's a fraudulent listing. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely fraudulent. This is not about fish. This is about taking control of the water, taking control of the lands, and moving us all to the cities.
So let's kind of follow the argument whether there are or are not. So first off, they're not native and don't qualify. Secondarily, whether or not there's too few, too many, or not. So let's just kind of take this a piece at a time. Of the number of coho salmon that are hatched in the river, they go out. Of course, they're an anadromous fish, so they are born in the freshwater. Then they go spend their lives in the ocean, and then they come back into the rivers to spawn. Do you have a feel for what percentage of the fish actually make it back to spawn?
Oh, very, very few. There are tens of thousands released from the hatchery on the Klamath River, but they're lucky if they get a couple of thousand back.
So there is a general agreement that the return rate is low. I don't know if it's is that a historically low number?
Yes, it
or
is. It's that way, been that way ever since the coho were planted. We do not have good returns, because genetically, the fish coho that return here are really from Cascadia, Oregon. And so their genetics would tend to send them back up to Cascadia, Oregon, even though they were planted here. That's their genetic identity.
Okay, so let's say that we have a large number go out, a few come back. I believe that the agency opinion is that somehow agriculture is the culprit for that. Is that correct?
Oh, they're blaming the agriculture. They're blaming the algae blooms in the reservoirs, and they're blaming people in general for everything. The reality is that in 2002, there was a fish kill of over 30,000 salmon in the lower part of the river. And it turns out that they immediately blamed the algae blooms in the reservoirs and demanded that the reservoirs and the dams be removed. However, the reality of that situation was that the Hoopa tribe, which is down further down the coast or further down the river, they called for a water boat celebration, surge of water, so that they could go out and do their water boat stuff. And at the same time, they were diverting 72% of the Trinity River, which flows into the Klamath. Now, that 72% was going to Los Angeles, and they did open up the dams, allowed more water for the celebration. This is a signal to salmon that, oh, time to spawn, let's go upriver. So they did, and then they stopped the flow right after the water boat celebration, and the water was so shallow and warm that tens of thousands died. Not only that, but there was recorded in the sheriff's departments a large methamphetamine dump into the river, which also made it toxic. So these truly were the reasons why that huge salmon kill occurred. And then we had the CDC out here in 2009, and they evaluated the algae blooms in the reservoirs, and they were found to be non-toxic.
So let's kind of take it through the life cycle. Let's go with it, because sometimes I know when I was listening to the stories up there and learning myself for the first time, and we're talking about salmon, it's easy to get lost. Are we talking about the adults coming back? Are we talking about the young going out? Why don't we just kind of start at the beginning of life? So we have a large number of coho salmon, or some number that are hatched in the river. I think fair to say that a relatively small number of them are dying having to do with anything agriculture. So let's just kind of figure out where they all go. So here's these small little fry. I know in the hatchery, the first little life experience these have before their relief is the maxillary clipping. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, actually, maxillary clippings was a terrible, terrible way to identify fish. What it really did is it made it difficult for them to eat properly. So many of them died because they just malnutrition. Then they went to just fin clip. Actually, they started with fin clipping. And that, of course, doesn't really hurt the fish at all. But the maxillary clipping was devastating to the salmon.
What's the maxillary? Why don't you explain what the maxillary is?
That's basically cutting the lower jaw. So it makes it easier to identify them when they come back to the hatcheries. But this, of course, hurts their feeding ability.
So they start their life, and they got one of their jaws cut off. And they're cut, I understand, with industrial-strength toenail clippers, it sounds like, from one description. But anyway, they cut these off so that they can tell when they come back to the fishery, the hatchery, that they're actually hatchery fish and which hatchery. So now, next thing, they go down. They're continuing down the river now. The next thing, if I recall correctly, is the infection zone. You want to talk about that?
Well, there has always been an infection zone. However, it really is not that terrible for the number of salmon. The biggest problem is actually when they get to the estuaries. In the estuaries, since the Endangered Species Act listed seals, there are tens of thousands of seals, and they just gorge themselves on whatever they can catch.
So if I recall the numbers you gave us earlier, the seals that they've been listed in the sea lions have multiplied by a factor of 19 times.
Something to that effect. Up in Washington, they're even sitting on the fish ladders waiting for the salmon. Unbelievable.
Okay. So these fish have had quite a little journey just to get down to the ocean. Now they get to the ocean. Why don't you talk a little bit about the oceanic effect here?
Well, the oceanic effect turns out to be the most significant in what's happened to the commercial fishing in California, Oregon, and Washington. With this historic rise in temperature of the Pacific, salmon are normally a cold water fish, and they have moved all the way up into Alaska, where now they're 97% of all species of salmon caught on the Pacific Northwest are caught in Alaskan waters.
And I remember that was down from 20%, correct?
Well, actually, the number was, the lowest number, I believe, was about 40%.
Okay.
But close enough.
So effectively, the ocean is getting warmer around California, Oregon, and Washington, and the fish don't like warm water, so they continue to go where the water is colder, which means they head up north towards Alaska, and that's where they're getting caught?
Correct. And what happened is, to try to figure out what caused the Pacific Ocean warming up to that tremendous amount. I mean, we haven't seen a rise in temperature since the 1700s. Nothing has ever shown this kind of a rise. And the thing is I then discovered that the Pacific Ring of Fire volcanoes, they too, if you took the graph of the temperature rise and the number of volcanic eruptions in the Pacific Ring of Fire, the two graphs lay on top of each other. We are in a middle of a planetary cycle. Now, last year and this year, the temperature of the ocean has dropped a little. Last year, it dropped, and they had a great run up in Washington. This year, it dropped a little more, and we had a great Chinook run this year here.
What's the effect of the El Nino?
Well, the El Nino, this is a cyclic effect. It goes up and down, and usually you're never talking more than 2 to 3 degrees. And when the temperature rises 3 degrees, the number of salmon coming back to us gets lower. When the temperature drops, we get more salmon back. They've known this for decades and decades. However, this rise in temperature has never been seen. We're looking at 7.5 to 10 degrees from 1970.
So it's fair to say that if, you know, you're a fisherman, a U.S. fisherman, and your livelihood is to fish off the coast of California, Oregon, or Washington, you're seeing a sharp decline in the number of coho salmon, or I guess all salmon,
right,
fishing there. So you probably think that, you know, numbers are going down, but in fact the fish are just simply going further north.
Yeah, if I were a commercial fisherman and look at the National Marine Fisheries Service data on the number of salmon and where they're caught, I just pack up my family and move to Alaska because that's where the fish are. Instead, they're being subsidized.
Yeah, how about the commercial fishing in the ocean itself? How does the size of the catch today as compared to what it would have been?
Actually, the catch in the ocean, you'll find that the foreign nations that come in here with their trawlers and their nets and all the rest of that, they're probably smart enough to move north where the fish are.
Maybe in terms of the total quantity of salmon being caught each year, how does that compare over the last 10 or 20 years?
Well, since in 1950, the total catch was 149,000 metric tons. In 2010, it was 403,000 metric tons, almost a 300% increase in salmon.
So the fishing is catching. Do you happen to know whether the growth of salmon is keeping up with that, or is that just overfishing compared to the increase the population of the salmon?
No, actually, NOAA and National Marine Fisheries Service are concerned with the tremendous population up in Alaskan waters. They're afraid there isn't enough microorganisms for the fish to really survive in those great numbers, and they're seriously considering shutting down the hatcheries. Well, more absurdity from National Marine Fisheries Service.
Okay. So a big chunk of these, so again, we're kind of looking at where did the salmon go from birth to coming back for their death when they give birth to the next generation. And so a big chunk of them go to commercial fishing, principally up in the Gulf of Alaska. The fish are now, the signals come up and they say, okay, it's time to go back and let's go have the new generation. So they start making their way back towards the rivers and the estuaries. And I think, like you were saying, the seals are more or less waiting for them and the sea lions.
Right, absolutely.
So it's principally the adult, when they're in the adult stage, that the sea lions become an effect. You have a seal predation, a seal lion predation, which has increased by some 19 times.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the seal population is so great that people who have boats, small boats at the docks along the coast, they're having the seals right on the docks, getting in their boats, threatening people, let alone eating fish. So the
okay,
ESA,
and then,
ESA hasn't really helped the salmon whatsoever. And the Yurok tribe, which is down on the coast here, they used to hunt the sea lions as part of their traditional tradition. Well, they've been denied the access to them, so now they're just all over the place. I mean, they're everywhere.
Okay. So now the fish are coming back. They have to get past the sea lions and the estuaries, and now the next thing that they incur as they try and swim upstream is, in fact, the Native American Indian fishing, the Yurok tribes and others. Is that right?
Yeah, well, they go ahead, and they're only supposed to have nets a percentage across the river. So what they do is they put one from the north side and one from the south side, making this a very tortuous path for the poor fish. And they're catching a lot of fish. And unfortunately, they're supposed to be using them for tribal ceremonies and for their own use. However, they have a tremendous commercial selling of salmon that they're catching, which is illegal. But that's okay. That's what they want to do.
Okay, so clearly then the federal government must be monitoring the take to make sure they don't take more than they should?
Not really. Not the Indians. They have an individual from the tribe that's appointed as, quote, the counter. So you can imagine how well they keep track.
So now the Indians have gone high-tech. I remember when I grew up, history books, you know, they show you the single Indian, you know, sitting on kind of a rock precipice over the river with some big long pole and a net out of it, scooping them out, you know, into this little net one at a time, kind of like a butterfly net.
Yeah.
I guess that's all been replaced with gill nets, just like the ocean fishing.
Absolutely. And they put them across about 80% across the river. And then, like I say, the first net goes from the bank of the west, north, south, and then the second one goes from south to north, making this very tortuous path that the poor fish has to go through to get out of the away from their nets.
Okay, now the next event, and you know, I learned in talking to you and others that, you know, the fish, when they come from the ocean, the estuary is kind of where the river meets the ocean, and it's a kind of a phase change. It's where the fish can adapt to switch from one environment to the other, so they hang around there for a few days or maybe a few weeks. And when they're coming home, they basically wait for cold, a rapid flow of cold water to indicate that the rains have started and that the rivers are now going to be flush with good, fresh, clear water, and that's what triggers them to go upstream to begin spawning. And you started to say earlier that this is interrupted. The Trinity River, so people can understand, is a river that's in close to the coast. It goes into it goes into the river close to the ocean, and what happens because of the tribal ceremony, they release a fair amount of this Trinity River into the other river, and that gives a trigger of cold, clear water and a wrong signal. The salmon began coming upstream thinking that the upstream waters are ready for them, and in fact they go back to being shallow and warm. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. Yes, they went ahead and did, like I said, the agreement was is when they started diverting water to Southern California from the Trinity River, they were never to take more than 48% of the river flow. The reality was when that fish kill occurred, they were pumping 72% of the Trinity River south, and this was a very large factor. In fact, National Marine Fisheries Service makes it very clear that the only thing that controls and helps the salmon is the reservoirs releasing the proper amount of water so that they can make their way up the river. The other problem is with coho specifically is since they like to go ahead and spawn close to the ocean, those ocean streams and creeks that used to be their normal habitat have been decimated by the major flood in the 60s and the 97 flood. And those need to be dredged out because they can't even have access to them anymore.
So those are those are actually the spawning grounds where they would be most effective. That's where they would actually tend to spawn. But those are is anybody addressing that as a problem?
Well, it's been reported in National Marine Fisheries documents and NOAA documents, but nobody's doing anything about it.
Okay, and they're making their way back to the hatchery then, and back up. Most of the, about 85% of the spawning occurs within 12 to 20 or so miles of the coast. The dams are approximately 200 miles from the coast, a long, long way, so this is generally not a natural area for them, but let's suppose they make some of it back up to go to the hatchery and so forth. Then what are the condition of the fish when they get up to that far in the stream or in the river?
Well, the historical account by the Indian tribes indicate that Copco No. 1 Reservoir, which is the furthest one east, which is really not that far from Iron Gate, they Indians claim that when the fish got that high, they were basically inedible, were sick, dying, and couldn't even spawn effectively. So these dams really have nothing to do with the spawning characteristics and habits of either Chinook and definitely not Coho. I mean, Coho don't go that far up rivers.
Now, there's one final piece in this whole round-trip story that I think is worth talking about as well, and that is that the hatchery itself, which produces about 6.25 million fish a year, 6 million of them are the king salmon that we eat, that most people like to have. About 250,000 of them are actually the trout, the steelhead trout, but they're anadromous, and then 75,000 of coho. So the government policy is only to make 75,000 coho a year. Is that correct?
That's correct, right.
So what happens with the extra coho salmon that come up to the hatchery and they get their quota satisfied? What do they do with the extra coho? Do they release them into the stream so they can have, you know, naturally hatch their fish?
No, they do not. They just toss them into great big bins, and then they go over to cat food factories. In fact, the ridiculous part of it is that the coho and the Chinook both, well, coho now are listed, and they claim that the catchery fish are no longer good fish. So they don't even take their eggs. They just kill them outright and toss them in the bin to go to cat food factories. Now, this is absurd. I doubt if there is a single, quote, wild salmon ever coming back into the Klamath Basin. It's been 116 years since these fish were planted in this river. I suspect the only fish that come back that do not have a jaw clipped or a fin cut are ones that spawn below the hatchery. And their returns come back, of course, fully finned and fully jawed, and they claim that, oh, these are wild salmon. That's absurd.
What percentage of the fish that do return, do you have a feeling what percentage of them are identifiable as hatchery first fish versus not?
I don't have the exact number. I know that the hatchery returns are the major portion of any return. And they're not counted anymore. Yeah, they had the environmentalists went ahead and filed an appeal to the ruling that we got from the courts back in the early fight with the coho. The early fight, the judge said the National Marine Fisheries Service listing coho and not counting hatchery fish was unlawful, arbitrary, and capricious. In 2006, the enviros filed an appeal, and they said, yes, they're genetically identical, but they act differently. And this judge went ahead and said, you're right, and so they don't count them anymore. Absurd.
I'd heard that it was like three quarters or more of the fish were actually were the hatchery fish. It was relatively a smaller percentage that were the so-called wild fish or the stream bred ones that weren't marked. There's one last final piece of the story that's interesting that I heard. I was actually interviewing a individual that used to work at the fish hatchery, and this was an interesting thing that when it came out, it just stunned me. So the adults are being, any excess adults that are not needed, rather than being put back in the river or, you know, put up in a stream or someplace where they could naturally hatch, they kill them. But then the next part of the story is they only want 75,000 of the fry, and they go ahead, and when they produce the fry, any excess over 75,000 of the fry are killed, either by electrocution or hot water or chemicals. But then the next question was, well, how many fry do you actually make in the course of a year? And the answer was 400,000 to 500,000 coho fry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the real absurdity is what in 2001, when I was part of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's hatchery evaluation, what had happened was when we first moved here on the river in the late 80s, you could almost walk across the river on the backs of the salmon. And then all of a sudden, that changed. And what happened was is they changed the protocol at the hatchery. It used to be that at the beginning of a salmon run, they would take about 30 or 40% of what they required to meet their goals. Then they'd shut down the ladder, allowing the fish to spawn naturally. Then they'd open it up again in the middle of the run and take another 30 or 40% and then close the ladder again, allowing the fish to spawn naturally. And then toward the end of the run, they took the rest of what they required. However, people were complaining over the dead-smelling salmon floating down the river and their dogs eating them and getting ill and having to have antibiotics. So now they take every fish that comes up the ladder. They don't turn the ladder off at any time now. And that was my recommendation after I got through evaluating the hatchery.
So we've now kind of completed this round-trip story. This was the thing that just got to me. There's a lot of details that go into the story, but the bottom line of this is that the argument is that somehow, you know, the dams have to go because we need to, there's too few of these, and we need to let blow up, you know, those dams that cost us, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars and spend $1 billion to blow them up and get rid of them so the salmon can go up. When, in fact, they're killing, I don't know how many adult salmon that are coming back up, and in terms of the fry, they're killing somewhere around 300,000 to 400,000 fry a year because, quote, that's beyond the quota that they have. And there's all these places in this round trip where large quantities of these fish are dying, either because the maxillary clip, the infection zone, the seal predation, the fishing off the coast here, the fishing up in Alaska, the tribal fishing that's really pretty much unmonitored, the early release of water. All of these factors, are any of those being considered, and are they doing anything to address any of those to try and increase the salmon?
Well, no, they're totally ignoring the ocean, which I believe is the prime problem with returning salmon to this basin. And the other thing is, what you have to realize is this is not about the fish. This is about government control. In 1970, NOAA published a report with the National Marine Fisheries Service stating clearly that the ocean temperature is warming and we expect salmon populations to move north into Alaskan waters. And then they waited till that happened, and they conspiratorially listed them as endangered when, in fact, they predicted they were going there. This is ridiculous.
So it's an interesting thing because I know there's a lot of details, the overall story. We're going to get to more of them in this show, but it's fascinating. Just even this one little piece of it kind of gives the, you know, the listeners some sense of what's been going on here. The ranchers and the farmers are fighting to survive, to keep their communities alive, to keep their ranches and farms going, because they know that when these dams are blown up, they're going to come back and take away their water, and then there goes agriculture, there goes the cattle as well. And they continue to run up, and they're doing more work, it seems to me, to analyze the real problems and try and come up with solutions than the government is. And this is just one part of the idiocy. Terry, would you like to bring out some other points?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm curious about, and I hope everybody can hear me clearly.
Doing fine.
I can hear you fine.
I'm curious, Dr. Gierek, how this is impacting your life. You live on that river. You've been there for 25 years. It's got to be changing things for you. It's probably changing your view of the government, for one, but it's also impacting your life there. And I'm curious to know how it's really impacting that community and if there's any concern whatsoever about the people from our government.
No concern at all about the people. And how it's impacted me is that since they indicated they were planning on removing the dams, my property value has dropped over 50%. And the most important part, though, is that all of the wells down this river, including the communities, which represent hundreds and hundreds of people, these are shallow wells. We're really taking the water from the Klamath, being processed through the ground, and then to our shallow wells. If they go ahead and remove the dams, that will go ahead and drop the level of the river, and most of our wells will dry up. And not only that, but the Iron Gate Dam that was built in 1962, it was built specifically for one major purpose, to go ahead and protect the people on the river from inundating floods. And this really is, my property is, like I say, I own a 20-acre wood rat bar right on the river, and in the 97 flood, it came within about an inch of coming over the bank and onto my property where my home is. Well, if they remove the dams, the first inundating flood, it'll wipe my entire property away. I hope that
happens. How about others? Is there anybody, You know, one of the things that Red Beckman, who's listening to us right now, has talked about, he's talked about how the IRS, for example, he calls it murder by suicide because they come in and they ruin people's lives. They don't care about the people. They destroy their lives. They destroy their families. And, you know, I suspect that this same sort of thing is going on there, that there's enough stress in the economy of this country without them shutting down logging and doing this sort of thing to the people. They're going to increase the price of the power in that area if they take away the hydroelectric. I mean, there's all sorts of impacts in this. And I'm just curious if you have any particular stories in that kind of vein where the people are just really conducting themselves differently and more dysfunctionally, I guess.
Well, basically what we've seen to date is when the mills were closed because of the spotted owl, over 750 families had to move out of the county because they couldn't find work anymore. And then here, just 2 years ago, they shut down mining in our river. And there we have businesses, RV parks, restaurants, food stores. They've all collapsed and closed because their primary business for the year was hundreds and hundreds of miners that came here. So they're decimating that. And if they remove these dams, then they'll probably wipe out a few communities and a heck of a lot of us that live on the river now.
How many theaters and blockbusters do you have?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
How many movie theaters do you have in town and blockbuster rental places?
Well, we have one blockbuster. We have one theater that is now basically closed because they don't have enough people to go ahead and pay their overhead and keep up their costs. And the biggest thing we've got in town is a Walmart that just turned into a Super Walmart, which will probably shut down the other two grocery stores that are in town. I mean, let's face it, our, quote, unemployment rate in this town is over 20% right now. And there are more people here on welfare, and we have a high crime rate because nobody can find a decent job, or any job for that matter.
Well, Dr. Garrick, I want to give you a little bit of a breather here and just let you kind of contemplate where you'd like to take this conversation. But we've got another doctor here online with us, Dr. Kate, who is a hydrogeologist. And I'd like for her to come on, and based on her experience, she's familiar with the Klamath River. She's actually done some work on that. But she's also got a pretty good picture of what would happen there to the lands, particularly along that river, if those dams were taken down. And I'd like for her to come on and give her analysis of that. But I'd also like for Red Beckman to be able to jump in here. Red, are you with us?
I'm listening.
When Kate's done giving us a picture of what's going to happen there, Red, I'd like for you to give your side of why you might think the government might be doing something like this and what they're really trying to do and maybe some ideas about what you would think that the people might want to do about this. They're already getting their sheriffs in the game. But maybe there's more they can do, and I just would like to get your feedback on that. Kate, are you on? Are you on?
Yes, I am. You know, the whole issue of dam removal has so many more complications, and in my view, in the Klamath as well as on the Columbia River, dam removal will destroy the lands and resources in that watershed. And the main reason, as you all know, water cuts down to its lowest level. So it's always working down to sea level, for example. But you have a series of dams in which the hydrology or the watershed above those dams has adjusted to that level of where that dam is and so forth. And as you go down, each part of the system has adjusted. And that means... That means stable stream channels, things like that. So if you remove the base level or if you change it, the natural thing for the water to do is to cut down. So that would mean gullies would develop. You wouldn't have nice flowing streams. You'd have very deep gullies developing all throughout the watershed, and it would take eons for that to finally readjust, because now everything is cutting down to the Pacific Ocean. So you can think of, you know, the river bottom itself, the streams that all the tributaries that flow into the river will all cut down. Now, if we take a look at these supposed habitat conservation plans and just jumping up to the Columbia River, for example, where they've forced everyone to come up with a habitat conservation plan controlling soil erosion and so forth, if you remove the Columbia River dams, all of that work and all of that taxpayer money and all of those monies and works will just be destroyed because the streams will cut down, cutting through all those quote-unquote habitat conservation plans. So not only is this for the Klamath River Basin a very serious problem, it's almost never talked about, but it is a major reason not to remove the dams. And, you know, the federal agencies have shown time and time again that they don't know about these processes and they don't understand them. Anyway, I wanted to get that in there because this is just such a huge and serious problem. It's not only the wells that will be affected, it's everybody's landscape. And that is one of the key issues to me. Thanks, Terry, for that opportunity.
Well, Kate, I know that you've also got some experience with government motivation, particularly when you're dealing with the Corps of Engineers and people like that. I'm wondering if you'd like to add here what you think some of their motivation might be.
Well, increased federal regulation over every watershed. That's all I can tell you, is if, you know, think of the situation when the dams are removed and all of a sudden the land becomes unstable. Well, the feds are going to have to come in and take it over because, you know, they'll blame it on the farmers and they'll blame it on everybody else, but not realize it their own actions. So, in my view, you look at the Corps of Engineers, you look at, in the Missouri River Basin, the intentional flooding that happened this year, the actions of the Bureau of Reclamation in the Klamath area, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and NOAA Fisheries. This is all about government control of the land base. What they're doing over in the Missouri Basin from the intentional flooding is the feds are buying out all the land for pennies on the dollar. Well, that's what's going to happen here. So it's all about federal control over water resources and the elimination of state boundaries, county boundaries, and essentially elimination of individual sovereignty and private property rights. So in my view, it's pretty clear when you look at the science and what the implications are of what the goals of the government are. It's complete control over watersheds.
Well, thank you very much, Kate. I trust that if Dr. Gierak or Kurt or these guys wanted to have some of their sheriffs to have some private conversation with you, in this regard, you'd be pleased to give your testimony to them, would you not?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime. Waiting to jump in.
Good to hear
Red Beckman.
I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Red Beckman, what's your thinking here?
Well, my thinking is she's absolutely correct. And the thing is, we have now went ahead and had a hydrologist here evaluate what would happen if they remove these dams. They have estimated 20 million cubic yards of material behind their dams. And a graphic representation, if they removed all four of these dams, the depth of sludge would be 6.5 feet deep at Iron Gate Dam right now. And that sludge would cover the 190 miles of the river all the way down to the estuary. And at the estuary, it would still be 6 inches deep. You know, this not only affects the species in the river, but would seriously affect wildlife that depend on the river. All spawning gravels would be buried under the toxic sludge. Otters, beavers, frogs, crawfish, mice, rats, birds, flyways are but some of the affected critters. This doesn't even begin to estimate the loss of insect life should this travesty move forward. We believe that the ESA was here to protect species. Instead, they're going to destroy them by the hundreds.
Red?
I have been listening to this, and of course, traveling the nation as I have, I've heard similar stories wherever I go. And of course, the big picture is rather ugly because we have no justice system anymore. The justice system is totally inept. I shouldn't say inept. The justice system in this country is so corrupt. Every federal judge, everyone, including the nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, could be prosecuted and jailed. Every one of them belong in jail, as far as I'm concerned. And I say that because we have a situation where these people, all of these, and that goes for U.S. attorneys and prosecutors as well. They belong in jail as well. I'm the co-author of the book, The Law That Never Was. I'm a Montanan, basically. However, I'm living in Washington State right now. But Montana, we had a few farmers and small business people and such in 1980. This is over 30 years ago. We were trying to make a difference in what was happening in our country, and someone suggested. I always said that the government they will never tell the truth if there's a lie that they can come up with, because they would rather have the lie than the truth. Anyway, these fellows got together. It was kind of an ad hoc committee, about a dozen people, that decided that they were going to find out if the 16th Amendment, the income tax amendment to our Constitution, had been properly ratified. And it took 3 years to get the information from the state legislatures, their debates, their votes and such in their sessions when they supposedly ratified the 16th Amendment. And it was almost scary what we found, and that is that in 1909 to 1913, our Congress and our state legislatures and such were totally manipulated. They were not doing their job, and we found that not one single state properly ratified the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. The American people have been ripped off for trillions of dollars by a law that is unconstitutional, a law that has no business in our law business, in our law system, and there is not a federal judge or a federal prosecutor or U.S. attorney in this country that do not know what we have. There's over 17,000 certified documents. We spent a lot of money putting this all together. Now, what I'm saying is that this is a situation where we have all of the records. We have everything that was ever put together on the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Not only the 16th, but the 17th as well. We the people in Montana did both amendments, the 16th and the 17th. So now what I'm saying is you're having a battle over the Klamath River, the dams. In Montana, they're having a problem with the importation of Canadian wolves that were not native to Montana. And the problems that they have created with those wolves is just unbelievable. It's every place you go, you will find this. And you are not going to get justice in the courts because the judges in the courts are absolutely, they are a criminal syndicate. They're all involved up to their eyeballs in criminal activity. And we have this one case, just this one case that I'm talking about, where we have everything to prove that they are criminals. No ifs, ands, or buts. It's all there. And we have judges or comments where they say, well, if you people are correct, there is no income tax in this country. But you will not find one of them that will go out and check and see whether the whether we're right or whether we're wrong. We're wrong because they say we're wrong, not because the evidence says we're wrong. It's because they say we're wrong. And there's a big difference. We have the documentation all certified. We've been in the courts now. The book, The Law That Never Was, has been out since April of 1985. That's over 25 years ago, and we have not been able to get that into a court of law. We have never been able to get a grand jury investigation. We've never been able to bring that evidence to a jury in a tax case. Never, because they block us every place. Everything we do, we get shut down. This is what's happening with you people on the river there and those dams. You're going to, you'll discover. Now, of course, there is a different situation here for the simple reason that you have some communities there that are becoming aroused, and the sheriffs, this is good news when we talk about sheriffs that are recognizing a problem, because we have not had that with this 16th Amendment question. You know, there's a lot of evidence that you have on the fish and all of that. They don't look at that. Agenda 21 is their Bible. That's their guide. And who put that together? It wasn't the people of this country. It was a few individuals with ulterior motives that they all belong in jail, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, I hate to throw cold water on what you're trying to do. That's not my idea. That's not my goal. I just want you to know that you're not alone, and we're living in a different political world right now than what we had 25 years ago. 25 years ago, as I was traveling the country, I wrote my first book in 1980, still in print after all these years. People would say, well, when is this all going to sort out? When is it going to end? And I said, well, I don't think anything will happen until we have a financial meltdown in this country. And when that happens, and when we have people losing their homes and no jobs and the foreclosures and all, I saw this all coming. And it's here. It's here right now. And so I would say that you know, the people need to understand that we're in a political war that I hope that we the people win. There's more of us than them. And so we've got to train the grand juries and the juries. If we had grand juries that would investigate, if we could get our 17,000 certified documents before a grand jury and be able to go through state by state and explain to that grand jury what has happened, I think we could get some indictments against some federal judges. The governor of Illinois, they've had pretty poor luck with their governors in Illinois, but they've sent them to jail. Well, we've got to do the same thing with a whole bunch of federal judges and federal prosecutors, and a lot of these lower level agencies that are trying to pull this off to wreck these dams and such. They just demolished a dam upriver here on the Columbia. Well, the dam wasn't on the Columbia; it was a river feeding into the Columbia. They just destroyed it, and it's going to be a real battle here coming up. And of course, I'm glad to see it. I'm not glad to see people getting hurt financially and everything, but if that's what it takes to wake them up, I guess that's the way it's going to have to be. And it's happening. It's happening right now. And I wish the best for you people. I'm 83 years of age, and the fight is just about gone in me because of my health and one thing another. But I'll tell you, I'm watching what you're doing, and I wish you the best.
Well, I thank you very much. You know, two points that they haven't even bothered to say. This is absolutely not about fish, and it's not about saving people. We went ahead and looked at the documents regarding what's in that sludge behind our dams. It turns out that the arsenic level is 1,000 times higher than the acceptable level. If they blow these dams and that arsenic gets into our water supplies, we're going to have a serious health risk. And not only that, when they blew the dams on the Rogue River, they found that behind their dams was chromium-6. And in just 3 years after the first dam was blown, the incidence of cancer caused by chromium-6 has gone up almost 300%.
Wow.
Scary.
Very scary.
So it sounds to me like we have to stop this at almost any cost.
You're absolutely correct. And the one point that you just made a few moments ago is that you can't get your documents introduced. The problem is that in the United States today, every court except in D.C. is operating under the military flag, which means they can tell you what you can and can't present. The only court in the land is in D.C. where you can go ahead and have common law where you can present all of your documents. And they can't stop you.
Let me inject one more thought here. Take a real good look at the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. There is the law that they have tried their best to bury. They don't want people to know, and they don't teach it in law schools. Lawyers don't know about it. What it really says is that a 7th Amendment common law jury is the highest court in our land.
Correct.
It is higher than the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, because the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court are 9 government agents. As long as they're on a tax-paid salary, they are government agents. And they don't like this brought to their attention. Now, I've had some very interesting conversations with attorneys around this country, and I have yet to find one that will argue with me about the fact that the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in the land, and when they make their decision, and this is what you need over there where you're at, you need a grand jury, and you need some cases under the Seventh Amendment common law jury trials, and then you challenge the Supreme Court to even attempt to review that, because the Seventh Amendment says the facts tried by a jury, no court in the land can reexamine their findings. There is a remedy, but we're going to have to educate a lot of people to get this remedy to work.
Problem is, the only common law court in the land is in D.C.
No, that's not true. Every court in the land, but you can't go into that court with an attorney. Because if you go into that court with an attorney, he's an officer of the court. He is under the thumb of the judge. But when you go into that court and you present your case to a common law jury, and you can educate that jury right in the courtroom at the trial, and the judge has to sit there, and he cannot interfere. He will come. I mean, I joke about it, and I say the extent of his power is to come in the morning and unlock the courthouse or the courtroom, and adjust the thermostat and the air conditioning or whatever. And he sits on that bench, and he's only there so that he can answer questions if either side asks for a question. And he has to say, well, I can't give evidence, but I'll tell you what I think this law means and how valid it is. But it means nothing to that jury. If they are properly trained, you and I, we the people down here at our level, we were to be the sovereign. Back in 1976, I heard Claire Kelly, a paralegal from the East Ohio, I think it was, and she gave a definition of what it means to be sovereign. She said it means that the one who is sovereign is the one who has the final say on the law. I've
Very
never found a better definition.
Kurt, did you understand Elo Jones when we were speaking with her earlier today to say that all grand juries fall under common law?
Yeah, I understood that. I think that, I don't know if you want to, you mentioned the future show or not, but this is something that's going to be explored, right?
Sure.
I think it's interesting to talk about these kind of remedies. It's interesting. I happen to have read, by the way, I got a copy of that book, The Law That Never Was, about 20 years ago, so I'm pretty informed on that. The last status I had heard, I thought that the courts had thrown it out because they said that it hadn't been properly certified, and I know there was an effort to go back and get it all certified. Is that what happened then?
Absolutely. We went through quite a process, and about $100,000 in the process because Bill Benson, the criminal investigator from Chicago that we got, basically we hired him to go out and get the certification of all these documents that the Montana historians had put together. And, Bill Benson, we couldn't have had a better man because he had a hard nose, he knew what he had to do, and nobody was able to slam the door in his face because when he walked into those places, he had his three-piece suit on and his cufflinks and the whole works, And he got everything. He spent, I think, if I remember right, about 3 weeks in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And they charged us quite a bit of money. Some of the states charged as much as $10 a page for the certification. And some states, the people in the archives were pretty hesitant about releasing or certifying what we had, but when they seen that we had a lot of these documents already, the real key documents, we had those, but they weren't certified. And, I mean, we were just a bunch of country boys, and we didn't know you had to have certification. And, of course, when I was a witness in a case in Hammond, Indiana in June of 1983, and that's how Bill Benson became involved, because he was there as a paralegal supporting Andy Spiegel, the defense attorney. It was a tax case. And Judge Moody refused to accept the documents put together by the Montana historians, and that was his excuse, was that they weren't certified. Now, you see, if he'd have been honest, he was a Reagan appointee, if he'd have been an honest judge, he would have recessed the court. He would have instructed the U.S. Attorney's Office to and the Justice Department to send the U.S. attorneys in each state. Give them each, he could have sent out the documents for each state to each U.S. attorney and town, say, I want certification on these. They should have given us the certification. They forget that we're the boss. They forget that we're the ones in charge, not them. They're just public servants, and they've turned it all around. It's all backwards. It's upside down, inside out, and they've just done that, and it's happened. And of course, this is the sad part about all of this. When you get to the bottom line of it, it's we the people that failed our country. The Constitution didn't fail. It was we the people who failed the Constitution. And that's what people have to learn, and they have to recognize, and they have to fess up to the fact that they were not doing their job. They weren't paying attention. And, of course, we let the government take over the schools, and that was a terrible mistake. We made a lot of mistakes, and we better face up to them, and we better say, hey, we're going to make some changes.
I have a question for you. It's a two-volume set book. I remember quite clearly with the blue cover and the whole thing. I actually reviewed that in quite some detail. It did not have certified copies at the time. Has that book been republished with certified copies?
Oh, yes. It came from certified copies. The book
I think
came
the one
after
that
we had all the certification.
I don't recall that.
And volume two, I don't promote, and my name is not on volume two. Bill Benson put, he wanted to put some lawyers' opinions in the book, and they're there. We had hundreds of pages of the U.S., the congressional record. I had gone to the library, the law library in Missoula, Montana at the university. They call it the Metcalf or Mansfield Library. I don't remember which it is now, but they have one of the few sets, or did at that time, 20-some years ago. They had the congressional record, the hard copies, and we had all this. These books, we had enough for a series of books. Like I say, we also had all of the documentation on the fraud involved in the ratification of the 17th Amendment, which also has caused us a tremendous amount of misery in this country. The 17th is probably more dangerous than the 16th in some ways.
We wouldn't be dealing with this indefinite detention of American citizen bill that the Senate just ramrodded through with 93 votes. The states with the ability to recall their senators.
Yeah, well, that was a terrible mistake, and of course, we the people let it happen. But I hope all of you will really study that Seventh Amendment, and if you have any questions, Terry can give you my phone number if you have any questions about it. I sued a federal judge in 1993, the senior federal judge in Montana. He had been a U.S. congressman, and he was a congressman, and Richard Nixon appointed him to the federal bench. I sued him and, under a Title 42 for damages, and the case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court in August of 96. You won't find that case. That case is still docketed. I have received nothing saying that the case has been thrown in the trash or anything else. They can't do that. Or I shouldn't say that. They can do anything they want, but that would really be a criminal act if they did. And, of course, when I used the Seventh Amendment in that case, it made a big, big difference in I have not filed an income tax return since 75, and they don't bother me. The last check I got from them was 140-some thousand on another case. And you use the Seventh Amendment, and I'll tell you, the U.S. attorneys and the judges are getting a tremendous education right now. Because we're really, you know, getting people to take a look at the Seventh Amendment. But you've got to use, you can have an attorney help you, but he cannot go into court and represent you.
It makes you a corporation. You cannot go in pro persona, being as yourself, a man on the land, if you will. You cannot do that and be represented by an attorney. If you do, you're basically falling out of common law. You cannot set a common law court with an attorney.
Right.
People don't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to take this one, that particular discussion further, so maybe we'd like to go back and finish up perhaps for a little while on the Siskiyou County story. You want to do that?
I agree. This all applies right there in that county today. And I know it's difficult to bring in too much information sometimes, and it can confuse people. But people really need to understand that they have a right to judge the law, and that they have a lot more power and rights. And then a lot of what these federal agents do when they come in is they really run a bluff, and if people know what their rights are and they understand their rights and they know that how to judge the law and how to bring their people together, they really need to educate their jury pool, and they also need to understand the grand jury system so that they can go and have their grand jury investigate these people, have the grand jury look into this, and the sheriff should be able to make that request and be able to provide evidence to the local grand jury, because some of this that they're doing is actually criminal in that it is unconstitutional. It's violating people's individual rights, their property rights. It's damaging them on civil issues. There's a lot going on that the people have the power to fight and to stop them if they're willing, you know, to not sit on the couch with the remote control. So, I mean, this applies right there in Siskiyou County.
Let me butt in here again. I use the Waco massacre to explain this people something. The Waco shootout, the initial shootout, happened on a Sunday. And the news spread across the county and across the state and across the nation in a hurry. And I think that Waco, that county, would have a minimum of 3 county grand juries. And a county grand jury has as much power as a federal grand jury. A grand jury is a grand jury. I don't care where it's at and at what level. And those grand jurors, none of them understood their responsibility. If they had had one person on one of those grand juries that had gotten to the other grand jury members right quick and explained to them what they had to do, and they could have called the sheriff. First of all, on Sunday afternoon, they would have had to get together a little bit, and the one knowing how to do it would explain what they have to do. And then they would call the sheriff, and they'd say to the sheriff, we're going to this grand jury number 1 or 2 or 3 is going to meet tomorrow morning, Monday morning, at 6 o'clock at McDonald's. They don't have to meet in a courthouse. They can meet in a church or any place. But he could have said, we're going to meet at McDonald's at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, and sheriff, we want you there by 6:15. Then he picks up the phone and he calls the county, the district attorney, and says, this grand jury number 2 or 3, whatever, is going to meet at McDonald's tomorrow morning, and we want you there at 6:30. The sheriff has been noticed to be there, and the sheriff has got to take he's under orders. His superiors are calling him and telling him what he's got to do. And then when they get done with the district attorney, they call the U.S. attorney for the state of Texas in their area and say, this grand jury is going to meet tomorrow morning at McDonald's at 6 o'clock. We want you there by 7. And there would not have been the murder of 20 some odd children as part of a group of people, 70 or 80 people that were murdered. It would not have happened. It would not have happened. You just think about that. I'm talking about some pretty serious stuff. And so there's something taught in school, and that is we learned about the checks and balances between the executive, legislative, and branches of government. We learned that in school. They did not teach us that the grand jury is another separate power. They didn't teach us that the trial jury is a separate power. The grand jury is to be a check against the Senate. It's a check against the House. It's a check against the judges in the courts. It's to be a check against the executive. Bill Clinton didn't think he had to answer a subpoena from the grand jury. He learned something about how our system is supposed to work. And so, you see, the grand jury, they have this massive power, this tremendous power, and they can tell the sheriff what they want him to do. And, of course, a lot of sheriffs aren't going to like what I'm saying, but that's the way it is, and because those are sovereign individuals on that grand jury. That grand jury in Texas would have been about 12 people, and every one of them would have been a king or a queen in our political system. And with that, I better keep my mouth shut here.
Well, Dr. Garrett, we've laid a lot on you. What thoughts do you have that you'd like to share at this point?
Well, basically, our sheriff has been identified as a constitutional sheriff. And in January next month, over 200 county sheriffs are going to meet in January with the Constitutional Sheriffs Organization to support and abide by the Constitution. We already have 6 county sheriffs here in Northern California and 3 in Southern Oregon that have determined that they too are going to abide by what they pledge themselves to, the Constitution, and not to the federal government. And this is a very, very good route that they're taking now.
A good start.
And our sheriff is going to be one of the members of the board of this new group.
I'm putting that website, CSPOA.org, which is where Sheriff Mack is talking about that and also asking for donations. I'm putting that in our chat box so everybody that's watching online or looking at the stream can see that and go there and check that out. He's raised what, a little bit over $50,000, and he's trying to raise $200,000 to cover the cost of housing and lodging and food and stuff for those sheriffs that when they show up. So he's I think that's if you're somebody's looking for a place to put some charitable donation, that could be a good one.
I agree with you 100%. We already have sheriffs here in our northern counties that the federal government and forestry are closing roads, and the sheriffs have stated outright to the feds the roads were not closed. A citizen that goes on them has the right to do that, and so do we for search, rescue, and fire. You know, another thing that they don't even talk about is the effect it's going to have on our forests if they remove these roads and remove these dams. These reservoirs are used by the helicopters to fill their buckets to fight these fires. They remove all of these dams. They're going to have to travel such a long distance to be able to fill their buckets that the forest fires will be out of control. Plus, forestry isn't even bothered to do forest management anymore. There was one community, I forget which state it was in, and then the sheriff organized what was called a tree party. They lived close to a forest that was not being managed, a lot of growth on the bottom, dead trees. Well, this tree party went in with chainsaws and equipment, and the sheriff, he put all of his people in riot gear and guarded the roads, and no feds interfered with the process of cleaning up the forest.
I think that for the listeners, you know, you've heard a number of shows about Siskiyou County under the Defend Rural America banner, and I think perhaps you can hear why this is so important. Siskiyou County has the elements that we're fighting at a global level in a microcosm. It's a microcosm of these problems. All these issues come to a focus. And what we have here is a situation where we have people like Dr. Jurak and the other people you've heard on this show who are standing up. They are fighting back. They're not taking this. And, you know, there was a non-binding Measure G where the people were allowed to vote dams in, dams out, and 80% of that community said, we want to keep the dams. So the people are on board this project. The county commissioners, for the most part, are behind this project. We have not one sheriff. We had 8 at the event on October 22nd, and now we have a 9th. So we have 9 sheriffs here. And they are now forming a bi-state alliance. This is no longer just, you know, one of the points I made before the event was that we have a regional problem. You have to have a regional response. And that is happening. We have over 50 different organizations in Northern California, Southern California, all the way down to the Bay Area, Northern California and Southern Oregon, and also down to the Bay Area that are behind Siskiyou County. So we have the conditions that are necessary, in my opinion, to stand up and win one. And I think that everybody who's listening, if not inside Siskiyou County, this is your fight too. And not just because it's Siskiyou County, and not just because of these legal issues. Ultimately, we're also talking about the food and the water and the energy and the building materials and minerals and so forth that are really the backbone of our national prosperity. And they are doing this across the country. They're trying to shut down our prosperity. And they're doing it an acre at a time. And, you know, a monument here and a closed forest there and removal of roads here and get rid of the agricultural farmers there and shut down the San Joaquin Valley over here. And, if you pull out the map and begin to take a look at all the national stories that are going on, you know, we are losing big time. This is not just a logic. It's not about what's right for this country. It is an assault on our national prosperity. And it is an assault that's unfortunately being led, wittingly or not, by a lot of these federal agents and state agents who are taking instructions from the top and who are ultimately taking their instructions from, it appears, from the United Nations, who itself is a basically just nothing more than a corporate structure for the international bankers to do what they want to do with the world. And we have a situation here where I think that we all have to stand together and come together and support this particular effort nationwide. We need national support on this, and not just from other rural areas, but we need to have urban people like myself in San Francisco Bay Area wake up and understand, hey, you know, we've kind of assumed all this stuff. We get food delivered at our table, and we can turn on the heat, and it's there. We've got energy for the lights, and hey, maybe that's not going to happen in the future. So it's time now to stand up and be counted, because I don't know how many more chances we're going to get, if any.
You're absolutely
Kirk, it's interesting you said that, because right before you started speaking, I was thinking about how the rest of the world looks at the United States and fears our freedom being destroyed because they believe that it somehow protects them, that we're the last bastion of freedom, and that now Europe is moving away from this unionization and you know, this communist socialist thing. They're wanting to move away from that, and they're watching us, you know, go down the tubes over here because of the complacency of our people, and they're scared to death because, you know, they recognize that it will impact them if we go down. And the same thing is true. The people out there along the Klamath River, and they're not the only ones. There's other people all across the country fighting this Agenda 21 stuff. But basically, this is just like you said, a microcosm. And it is, if they're able to do it there, where else do they go? Where do they go next? And this is a battle for a national state sovereignty, is what it really is. They're destroying our state sovereignty and the individual rights of the people are protected by that state sovereignty. It's the only thing that can really stop the machine from coming in and stepping on individuals today, because the courts won't do it.
Go ahead.
These guys are on the front lines. This is a systemic battle that's going on, and this is just a one frontline battle.
So what I say to the listeners here, you know, I don't know if you're getting tired listening about Siskiyou County or not. We've been at this for several weeks now, but I would say to you, this is not a play. This is not a show. This is not something that's being written in New York City. This is the real thing, and this is a real battle, and this is where the real fight is. And we're going to continue, and with Terry's help and Dr. Kate's help and Red Beckman's help, we're going to continue to peel back every aspect of this story so that people that are outside of Siskiyou County can see the absolute falsity of all of the government arguments. You can see what destruction and havoc this is going to raise, as well as we're going to be talking about the constitutional issues and grand juries and the Seventh Amendment, 16, 17. We're going to get and peel all of that stuff, because I think to address this particular incident there, it all plays. And I think that's what's happening. We're coming together. Everybody that has been separate, you know, I do something on money, and Terry's been doing something over here, and Red's been working on that, and, you know, the Tea Party's been doing this. No more. We all come together, whether it's Tea Party, Campaign for Liberty, a libertarian group, a conservative group, a democratic group, you know, it's somebody who believes in the Second Amendment rights, or somebody believes in the 17th needs to be challenged, the 16th needs to be challenged. I personally believe the 14th needs to be challenged. Constitutional scholars, we all need to bring the focus somewhere where we on our side have critical mass. And we have to have critical mass in terms of our thinking. We have to have critical mass in terms of our strategy and our planning. We have to have critical mass in terms of our organizational structure. And we certainly have to have critical mass in terms of our ability to communicate to a wide audience. And I thank you again for your show doing this. And I hope that people continue to follow this story, because this is going to be a fascinating journey through all of the elements that are ailing our country.
if I can interject, I'd like to go ahead and read something that my wife wrote after we fought the early coho salmon in the 90s. We find ourselves, the article she wrote was entitled Moral Conservation. We find ourselves splintered into a multitude of various ideologies, to name but a few: property rights, wise use, constitutionalists, environmentalists, militias, home rule, and a plethora of others. The one common denominator is that most of these groups find themselves funded by a host of different factions. Once funded, these groups then are beholden to those factions. Yet, if we attempt to achieve our goals without funding, we find ourselves ineffective and frustrated. There must be a solution to this paradox, and we believe that a new banner must be raised that will include all the groups. Moral conservation and the battle cry of the ideology should be do no harm. Although it sounds simplistic, it is the key to taking back our rights and achieving our goals. We all want our constitutional rights, and we do not want to see our resources and environments destroyed. The architects of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights could not have in their wildest imaginations or nightmares foreseen the day that fish, birds, lizards, trees, weeds, and an infinite number of other species would abrogate the rights of humans. What is moral conservation? Do no harm to that which you own. Treasure your properties and respect those that surround you. If you purchase land in the forest, live in harmony with that forest and don't clear cut it. If the desert's your forte, don't plant huge lawns and plants that are not indigenous. If we respect that which we choose to call ours, then are none that can fault us for what we do on our own property. In conclusion, we must have our government remove regulatory processes that infringe upon the innocent as well as the guilty. They may also be held to the contracts, deeds, and patents which they issued, regardless of when they were instituted. And this my wife published back in 2000.
That's well written. Sounds like we need to get her writing some more.
I think so. That was very well done.
Yeah, I'm very proud of her for that article. And that is when we had our interactive Citizens United that fought and won the battle over the 300-foot. And I do agree 100% with what she has stated here. Do no harm.
Well, we do have open phone lines. If anybody would like to call in and ask questions or contribute a comment, we've got about 20 minutes left here in the show. And, Kurt, how would you like to close this out?
Well, when you get into the global issue, it's kind of hard to come back to the local issue. But, you know, I think probably the thing we could do is spend I think the grand jury thing we should set aside for its own show and come back and really address that as a whole. I think we could probably come back to some part of the Siskiyou County story and probably just touch upon further parts of this. I know that Dr. Jurek has largely looked at the science of this, and that's where I think really has an interesting perspective. Jurek, I know that you have had some unique insights. I haven't heard from anybody else, which is why it's really great to talk to you. I know that the oceanic effect, the warming of the ocean, was somewhat unique. That was, I think, original to you, the seal predation and some of these things else. Perhaps if you have some other of those things that you'd like to share that perhaps we haven't heard or others haven't talked about that you have, that would be great to hear.
Well, basically, this is all a farce. The government is using junk science, out-and-out lies, to go ahead and achieve their agenda, which, of course, is to take away all our rights. The interesting point is that National Marine Fisheries, we defeated them earlier on the coho. They have not tried to relist them as endangered again. And now they have a state that has done it. So they're trying everything they can to go ahead and take us apart little by little, take away our water rights, take away our agriculture. They want us to go ahead and import all our food, import all our other stuff. And as far as power and energy, to remove these dams, which is the United States Geological Survey makes it clear on their home pages that hydropower is the cleanest, most renewable green energy on the entire planet, and yet they're ripping them out. If they replace them with natural gas, we will be looking at prices up to triple of what we're paying now for power, which is absurd. And again, not only that, but we're going ahead and be releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I mean, it's totally ludicrous that the global agenda is to remove all dams in the world and return the rivers back to their, quote, original condition. Well, the original condition of the Klamath River is very clear from historical records. Swamps, marshes, and mosquitoes in the summer because the river darn near dries up. And the Indians called the Klamath River, their definition of that is the stinky river. When the first explorers came into this particular basin, their donkeys wouldn't even drink out of the river, and the explorers had to go further north to find water that was potable. So, you know, this is nothing about fish. Removing these dams will destroy all fish populations in this basin, and they know it, but they could care less. This is about moving us out of the forests, turning them all into wilderness. In fact, right now, Secretary of the Interior has indicated they are introducing over 1,400 wild wolves into southern Oregon, which is about 15 miles from my property. And then they're going to go ahead and take 17 million acres of southern Oregon and turn it into wilderness. Again, more of this global agenda that continues to come down upon us. At the moment, we feel like we are in the center of the cyclone. And I hope that anybody who has questions or can assist in any way, we would appreciate it. That's for sure.
Gentlemen, we have three callers. Are you ready to take some questions?
Sure.
Area code 951 is first up.
My name is Keith Broders, and I just want to call and commend you guys for putting together an awesome program tonight. You brought up some tremendous points. And the thing that I wanted to just mention most is that Sheriff Richard Mack, as far as I'm concerned, is the latter-day Thomas Jefferson of our era. And Sheriff Mack is putting together this program, which was mentioned earlier, where he is going to have a convention in Las Vegas on January 30th. He's trying to get anywhere from 150 to 200 county sheriffs there so that the sheriffs could learn how they can honor their oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution and stand between we the people and an abusive federal government. And I would like to encourage everyone to please support Sheriff Mack in this endeavor. He, frankly, in order to be able to fund this, he needs an additional about $20,000. And if we can get some more contributions, we can basically start to turn this thing around. Because with Sheriff Mack's program, if we have constitutional sheriffs, it doesn't matter who the president is, because we're going to be able to neuter the president by having county sheriffs that know and understand their role in being the guardian of our freedom.
Well, we want to help them in every way, and that's why we're focusing this show on that. And it's also, we're going to be doing some more shows specifically related to the sheriff's duties and what their abilities are to use, particularly the grand juries, in order to strengthen their battle to be constitutional sheriffs. And I really appreciate your comments. Was it Keith?
Yes, and the thing, too, is please, everybody, go to sheriffmack.com, or you can also go to his website, which is www.c, that's constitutional sheriffs, cspoa.org, and you can learn how you can help Sheriff Mack restore our constitutional republic.
Thank you.
Thank you. By the way, thanks for the correction on my video.
Yeah.
Area code 518, you're next.
Yes, can you hear me?
We hear you fine. What's your name?
Skip Stranahan, We the People Foundation. I work with Bob Schultz up here in New York, and a lot of my family founded a lot of Oregon towns, Hood River and so forth. I'm very concerned about these dams. I'm wondering how far you've gone with an environmental impact statement. These people that want to blow these dams up, they prepared environmental impact statements to show what the damages will be downstream and how it will affect the river, and if it will take maybe 50 years to heal up afterwards so that there can be an efficient period.
Yeah, I've already went ahead and submitted four different EIR responses, Siskiyou County Water Users Association has also submitted documents, and so has the County of Siskiyou County. So we are definitely responding. However, we don't believe that they really look at them. They have an agenda, and they could care less what we say, but I appreciate the comment and the suggestion.
Well, I think there must be some mining laws, too. My people were big in mining up there in Boulder, Montana, and all through the area there, and you got arsenic behind those dams. You've got the chromium-6 behind those dams. How can these people be allowed to release that into downstream?
I totally agree with you 100%. And our mining association here, too, is being led by a gentleman by the name of Jim Foley, and he, too, is responding. And I, myself, am a dredge miner, which has been idle now for a couple of years because they stopped us from working anymore.
Well, as a miner, you know that those chemicals are there, that they exist, and the proposals that they have would be to release toxins into the downstream area. It seems to me like there'd be laws against that, environmental laws of their own making that would prohibit that.
Well, you would think so. As I said earlier, the amount of arsenic in the sediment is 1,000 times higher than the EPA allows. If they release that sediment, these shallow wells and along the river and communities are going to be pumping arsenic into their water.
And these people won't be held liable for any of their actions as far as not as violating these laws and not meeting these standards?
Well, they will.
Only if the people hold them accountable.
Well, I really appreciate what you people are doing out there, and I hope I can get out there this summer to do some more. I do travel out there. My wife's from Idaho, and I go to Bridger Canyon. I have family there, and I'm out in that area up to Stranahan's Ridge, up by the Cloud Cap Inn there by Hood River, and I'm in that area quite a lot. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I hope that we can somehow help you with some fun. And I did post it on our Facebook out here, and we're trying to see if there's something we can't do for you. I have some good friends out there, too.
Skip, if you would, this is Kirk, if you would, if you go to defendruralamerica.com, would you email me or just email me at Kirk, K-I-R-K, at defendruralamerica.com, and we can hook up. This is what I'm doing nationwide. And just so you know, there's some real experts in the mining slash private property thing that we're going to be doing in the future that go back to laws in the 1880s, 1870s, 1860s. I mean, fundamental private property, we will be getting into that stuff. So hang on, this is going to be an interesting ride.
Yeah, we have also two other websites that you can gain a tremendous amount of information. One is SaveTheDams.com, and the other one is Siskiyou County Water Users Association.com, and they, too, have tremendous amount of information.
Okay.
You better spell Siskiyou.
Okay. S-I-S-K-I-Y-O-U.
Okay. I'll be able to handle it real well. Actually, I'm very familiar with the river and the dams and the area, the western area there, Beaverton, Oregon, and those places are actually, a lot of my family lives there. And so I'm really, I have no problem with it, getting the spelling and getting the sites. And Kirk, I do have you, your email comes in here on a daily basis. So.
Oh, good, Skip. I didn't realize. Keith and I exchanged some email just actually today. So. Oh, I have you. There you are, Skip. I got you. I'll have a follow-up with you for sure.
Awesome. I'd really like to do that, and I'd really like to help with some funding or whatever I can do here. I own and operate the American Tree Company, and I'd be really proud to help you folks out with this issue.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in.
I actually ran out of battery, and I had to go to my cell phone.
Well, area code 303, that's Colorado. You're next.
Yeah, it's a Colorado phone, but I'm just listening. I didn't call that talk.
You're just listening?
I am.
Well, good. We're glad to have you with us. Area code 415, you're live and next online.
Okay, that I guess would be me. I'm calling because it seems to me, and I'm sure everybody is aware of this, that the agenda is to privatize water. So, I mean, the powers that be, they actually own the biggest water aquifer in the world, which is the Amazon. And that was, they bought that from Reverend Moon, who had bought it years before. So I'm really not in a position to be able to follow that through, although I do know about the agenda on privatizing water. So that would really fit in with all the things that are going on with water.
Dr. Kate, would you like to respond to this caller? She's muted, so. Anyway,
let me jump in on this one.
Go right ahead, Kurt.
This is interesting. I've had some recent conversations with some very interesting people. You can listen in on those conversations on the Defend Rural America website, because I'm talking to a lot of people, and those who agree, we record them and we put them up there. You can listen, and there's some really fascinating conversations. One of them was a hydrologist. It was in Central Valley, now retired, by the name of Ron Artino, and you can find it up there on the website. We were talking about this a bit, and, of course, the prevailing view is this is Agenda 21. He actually had another view, and this is about taking control of the water and redirecting that water going down to the southern part of California. And apparently there is now a super tunnel being built, and I did actually look at some articles here recently. They're building a water tunnel to carry this water from north to south that's big enough to put a small plane through it. I mean, we're talking about a really big tunnel, a super tunnel from Sacramento down to the San Joaquin area. And this is also the area where we're fighting the rapid transit system, the bullet train concept, which is, you know, the battle is whether it goes down I-5 or it actually goes over into Fresno area. And it seems to me that there's a plan. There may be, well, and there's another little piece of fact in place, that is there are politicians like Boxer and Feinstein are buying property in Fresno area. There may be a plan afoot to try and develop Fresno as the new, you know, expansion place for L.A., or either that or kind of put up the pieces and then shift it all to L.A., but they may be trying to build another community, another L.A. out there, and they're lining up the water, they're lining up the transportation systems, and going to make a whole ton of money for themselves by buying the properties in the San Joaquin Valley at these now very distressed prices because all the orchards are dead. So there's more to the story coming.
Yes, yes, I can see. So they're directing it the way they choose to.
Yeah, there's no question that people that are reframing this world, it's amazing that, you know, they want to change the world or they want to make a ton of money doing it. I mean, everything they do, even the central bank, I mean, the Federal Reserve basically allows the government to operate by putting us into debt. I mean, and that makes
sure,
the international bankers even richer. Everything they do, the global warming, well, how is that going to be done by credits? My God, we have to buy air allotments. So, you know, everything they do is also part and parcel of them becoming more powerful, richer, and I think ultimately having legal title to the planet.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that. I believe that. Oh, now I'm hearing my voice on TV. I mean, on the Internet. I wanted to say that I know that Bechtel took over the reconstruction of the water system in San Francisco, and this was at least 10 years ago. And they closed up any sources where there were springs. They immediately closed those down.
Bechtel's in the thick of this thing, and just so you know, when we were talking about this country, there's a national discussion whether we're going to go into Iraq or not go into Iraq. You know, this was being debated, and most people didn't think we'd do it or wouldn't. You know, months, I mean, somewhere about 6 to 9 months before that, I sent out an email to a group of people. I said, we're going in, and the business is going to go to Bechtel, and it's going to go to the Bush-Halliburton. And sure enough, what happens, Halliburton wins a reconstruction contract for an entire country with no competitive bid, and Bechtel's in the thick of it. Let me tell you, things are really dirty. And things are happening for different reasons. They give us cover stories that we buy into, or even if we don't buy into them, like global warming, then they just continue the story in order to continue the policy. But it has nothing to do with what they tell us. There is definitely a secret agenda here, which is becoming increasingly visible, which I think is why they're increasingly ratcheting up the spying and all the domestic stuff and building up their their armed forces, you know, in terms of the Forest Service and everything else. I mean, Washington, D.C. is going through an explosion right now because they're hiring government people as fast as they can. So it's going to be an interesting race between our ability to take our separate, disparate groups and begin to become a cohesive whole and get the information out to an expanding group of people, even as we take the ones that are already awake and we move them toward being an effective, synergistic group of people who can have effective plans to win. We continue to expand the message. That is in the race versus their ability to put in enough spy planes and, you know, monitor our iPhones and our TV sets and everything else to make sure that they have the upper hand. It'll be an interesting race.
Well, that's a great idea because they're starting to crack down on the occupiers, and that worries me. Although
yep.
that's much larger than anyone's even aware of. In the
end result, right now there are hundreds of issues, if not thousands, and we got different groups across this nation chasing every single one of them. And the last, I don't know how many emails I get, last minute panic. Oh my God, I just learned about SB dot 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 or HR dot dot dot, and oh, fax your congressman and call your congressman and sign this petition. Hey, that's all a waste of time. What is lacking is a vision, to an understanding of what this world really is, and a vision and a strategy and a plan to get it back. And I put out a YouTube video called How to Take Our Country Back that has now exceeded 36,000 views. It's growing at the rate of about 100 views a day. Slowly but surely, people are beginning to come behind that concept. And I encourage anybody listening to the show, go to YouTube and watch the video series, How to Take Our Country Back.
Okay, that sounds good. That sounds good. I'll do that. So,
thank you for calling in. We appreciate your input.
Yes, well, thank you for being there for me. You know, I actually think that the occupiers, there's a group that is sort of trying to organize them all around the world and to simplify their message in terms of what's the most important. And so I think this is the growing stages of that.
Who is that? I'd
like to
think
that.
Brotherhood?
What?
Are you talking about the Muslim Brotherhood?
No, I mean, no, I don't think so. No.
S-E-I-U?
That would be too obvious.
Those are the people who are organizing it. Van Jones started the whole thing. He and SEIU and the one in Orlando is run by the Muslim Brotherhood. Anyway, we're getting off topic. We've got about 2.5 minutes left. I want to give Dr. Gierak the opportunity to give some final comments.
Well, the final comments that I have are very basic. We need people to get involved. If you're having a problem, go to one of the three sites that we just gave out and let us know what your problems are and join us. Only we, the people, will have the power to go ahead and take back our constitutional rights. And that's pretty much where it's at. And get together with your sheriffs. These are the gentlemen and ladies that can do us the best good locally. And thank you for the comments.
Kurt, got a minute and a half. Final words?
Well, it's so I just repeat myself. So Siskiyou County, in my opinion, is a battle line that we have to draw. And we have to bring everybody together on here and keep people listening to the show and being active because we are going to be peeling this all back. And we do at the same time need to have a bigger global strategy here. And I think that's why I did the video. I think more and more people are beginning to realize that the ideas that are in there, such as the ability to take our existing organizations, whether it's Tea Party, 912, Conservative Forum, you know, Second Amendment group, whatever the name of it is, or some forestry group or some mining group or, you know, association I'm talking to in Indiana now that's, you know, bikers in fact figured out how to organize. We all want the same thing. It's a matter of a formula that allows different organizations with different leaders and different focuses to come together in a synergistic way. And the backbone for that plan is communicate, coordinate, and cooperate. C3, independently, let people keep each of these organizations, keep their identity, keep their leaders, keep their ability to make decisions. But I think those that are good will come on board and realize
there's more to be gained by working together, that you cannot win these issues separately. So it's time for us to take a leaf from the other side and begin to organize and come around people that do have a vision, do understand how all the pieces fit, and get on board that plan. I think Siskiyou County is one of those battles.
We are out of time. Thank you, Kurt. Thank you, Dr. Gierak. Thank you, Red. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, listeners. We'll be back next week with another great show. We'll be
I was there in the winter
a couple
of
64. Weeks on grand juries and sheriffs. So talk to your sheriff, get to know them, and get them to come and listen to what's going on here. Have a great night.
300 miles our trail had led.
God bless.
We barely had time to bury our dead. When the Yankees charged and the colors fell, Overton Hill was a living hell. When we called retreat, it was almost dark. I died with a grape shot in my heart. Say a prayer for peace for every fallen son. Set my spirit free. Let me lay down my gun. Sweet Mother Mary, I'm so tired, but I can't come home till the last shot's fired. In June of 1944, I waited in the blood of Omaha's shores. 21 and scared to death, my heart pounding in my chest. I almost made the first seawall when my friends turned and saw me fall. I still smell the smoke, I can taste the mud as I lay there dying from a loss of blood.
Our spirit free. but we can't come home.
No, we can't come home.